Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. For decades, San Francisco was a gathering place for many different kinds of people who found themselves at the margins. Single working women, transgender people, immigrants. Fly Away Productions choreographer Joe Kreider explores that history in a new aerial dance performance. It's called Tender, A Person Who Takes Charge. It's an exploration of San Francisco's Tenderloin neighborhood as the home to the outcasts and impoverished members of society. But it also pays tribute to how those outcasts reshape the neighborhood. The performance takes place at the Tenderloin Museum, which is dedicated to showcasing the history of marginalized communities with the gravity it deserves. Joe Kreider is choreographer, site artist, and director of Fly Away Productions. It's an incredible dance company that exposes the range and power of female physicality. Fly Away dances at the intersection of social justice and acrobatic spectacle. And Joe Kreider joins me in studio. Hi, Joe. Great to see you.
Hi, Rose. Great to be back.
Nice to have you back. And we're also joined by Katie Connery, executive director of the Tenderloin Museum. And Katie also joins us in studio. Hi, Katie. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, if you are in the area, Tender runs from June 7th to the 16th at 380 Eddy Street with performances at 8:30 p.m. on Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. A matinee performance at 12:30 will take place on Friday, June 8th and 15th. The performances are free and open to everyone. Joe, you have been on the show many times. You have done so many amazing dance pieces about social justice activism. Before we talk specifically about this piece, give us a thumbnail sketch of Fly Away Productions and what your overall goal is with your art.
Well, I mean, just to say it in two words, art transforms. And I'm interested in transformation that affects people's lives who don't necessarily have access to power. I'm interested in highlighting the experiences of women in the margins. I've spent 22 years with that goal. And at times, I expand the vision to include activism that transcends the experience of women to the experience of the whole of, you know, a community, a neighborhood, a street, a group of people working in a particular way.
And why did you decide to focus specifically on the Tenderloin this time around?
Well, this is actually our eighth year working in the Tenderloin, so it's part of a continuum of focus. The Tenderloin is one of the most fascinating neighborhoods in San Francisco, if for nothing else for the fact that it houses the essence of income inequality. It houses the most wealthy and the most impoverished members of our city. All in 33 square blocks. 31 square blocks. That's why Katie's here to help me with my facts. And so that creates a fascinating dynamic. And it's also, you know, it's ground zero for the problems we need to solve as Americans.
Right. Tell us a little bit more about the Tenderloin, Katie, for people who are not that familiar with the neighborhood.
It's a working class neighborhood right in the heart of San Francisco, and it's probably the only working class neighborhood right in the middle of a major U.S. city that still exists.
And talk about just, I mean, we've seen massive changes in the Tenderloin over the past, you could say, 5-10 years.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Tenderloin has always been a working class neighborhood. A group of activists in the 80s got together to pass a lot of legislation through City Hall to preserve it as a working-class neighborhood. There's lots of regulations about where you can have businesses, not above the ground floor, about how high you can build. A lot of the affordable housing is protected. So it's really been very consciously preserved. And while there's new businesses opening, we're not seeing the kind of displacement we're seeing in other parts of the city.
Mm. And Joe, as you said, you have done a lot of pieces in the Tenderloin. And this particular piece really looks at people who take charge, and it looks at the history of outcast activism. Why did you decide to take that angle specifically?
Well, there's two origins of the piece that I like to speak of. In 2015, when we were making a dance called Needles to Thread about women and wage security in an alley, in Continuum Alley in the Tenderloin, two things happened. Someone from the Vietnamese community approached me and said, "Wow, I'd love for you to tell our story because I think my community feels very unheard here." Mm. Simultaneously, someone came to me and said, "There's this museum opening a few blocks away called the Tenderloin Museum." And I put those two things together. And when I met with Katie for the first time, she pointed out Randy Shaw's book about the Tenderloin. And I read it, and it is an amazing, to my mind, prescriptive outline for how to make a site-specific aerial dance about 100 years of activism. I mean, I don't think that's what Randy meant when he wrote it, but that was how I read it. Outcast is the word that he gave me through the book. And because I was engaging with a museum that focuses on history, I mean, I think, you know, there is a long school of historians who talk about telling the history to affect the present and to not, you know, ignore the history that's not necessarily written in the books. And I think the history of transgender activism in the neighborhood and the Compton's cafeteria riot, you know, that's not written in the history books quite yet. So it's really an honor to be part of a storytelling mechanism through dance and through public art that brings those stories forward.
And how did...
Like to comment that history didn't exist in any kind of form until Randy wrote that book. The Tenderloin's been largely ignored or written about negatively throughout its entire history. It's been left out of every history book about San Francisco. So there, you really could not have read a history of the Tenderloin until Randy researched and wrote this book. You'd have to dig through multiple different archives. And that's the whole museum is based on the research done in that book as well. So with this dance, we're really seeing our exhibits come to life.
You know, it's so true because the Tenderloin is often written off as the bad part of town or, you know, have you driven around the Tenderloin at night? Can you believe what's going on there? And activists who live there, people who live there, always say, and it's sad that they have to say this, but it's a vibrant, rich culture, and people are doing such good work there. There are a lot of children living in the Tenderloin.
I've never seen a sense of community like I've seen in that neighborhood.
Yeah, talk more about that.
Everyone knows each other. There's a whole tribe of nonprofit workers there that are really, I mean, all the social services in the entire city are in the Tenderloin or in Soma. So really the whole neighborhood is flooded with nonprofits and services. And I mean, you see some really extreme income inequality in that neighborhood. And I think for some people, they just want to point to the Tenderloin somehow as being the cause of that, where really there's lots of people doing a lot of good work in the Tenderloin to try to address some of those huge problems that we're having in this country.
Hmm. Joe, before you started doing a lot of work in the Tenderloin, and what's amazing about your pieces is they're usually or almost always outside on a wall.
Yep.
And so you're interacting with the community on a regular basis, especially when you're practicing. And what was it like for you in terms of what you knew about the Tenderloin before you started working there?
Well, my first engagement with the Tenderloin was in 1987, where I was not yet a dancer, and I worked for something called the General Assistance Advocacy Project. So my roots there go back to being part of the advocacy and activism of the neighborhood. I didn't stay with that job because I just felt called to dance and really shifted gear and pulled myself more into that way of being in the world, an artist's way of being in the world. So, I mean, I had been in SRO hotels. I would go pick people up, bring them to their administrative hearings with general assistance, work to get them restored onto benefits because a lot of people get kicked off and don't have the wherewithal or the tools to represent themselves in a system that can be very bureaucratic. And that's what the GA Advocacy Project was all about. It was founded by UC Hastings law students, and UC Hastings has been one of my best collaborators in the neighborhood as an artist. Mm. So there's a lot of full circle for me in the Tenderloin. I have had a long, long-term relationship with the neighborhood.
And when you mention SRO, we should say that single room occupancy. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of SROs in the Tenderloin.
Yeah, more than anywhere else in the city. Right. And to a large degree, the history of the Tenderloin has to do with the history of a high density of affordable housing.
Joe, what do you think about the changes that we're seeing in the Tenderloin? What stands out for you?
You know, having worked there in an advocacy role in 1987 and being present there as an artist in 2018, in some ways there aren't a lot of differences. There is a culture of poverty and deprivation that has persisted, that has not changed, and I would say, in fact, has gotten a lot worse. I mean, of course, the housing crisis in the city is manifested in the Tenderloin as well. There are so many people on the streets in the day, and then they go into the shelters at night. And that's one of the reasons we chose to do matinee runs on a Friday, is that it's an entirely different city in the day as at nighttime.
Yeah, it's a really different community of people in the day and nighttime.
And one of the things about this project is that we've been gifted with incredible funding from the Reinen Foundation that allowed us to hire Code Tenderloin, which is an organization dedicated to getting people work, just really basic goal of getting people work who are living in the margins. And I'm thrilled to have this partnership with Code Tenderloin, and they are providing us with the folks who are our event team. And so that's something I'm really, really proud of about the project.
Is that the first time this has happened?
It's been my desire for years, but it's the first time where we as an arts organization have raised the funding to deepen our placemaking presence in the neighborhood and have a core of people working for us who live in the neighborhood.
What has the reaction been like from people living in the neighborhood throughout this process?
Okay, I'll give you a very specific...
So varied. We've had lots of people come to watch rehearsals, for sure.
Oh, thousands of people have watched rehearsals. But last night, during dress rehearsal, I was standing outside, and this man was standing next to me who lives in the Verona Hotel right across the street. And he is a Vietnamese man, and we happened to be about to watch the section that is about the story of the Vietnamese community in the Tenderloin. And so I stood next to him, and we watched it together. And I said to him, "Did you see your story in the story?" And he said, "Yeah, I saw my story. Thank you. I'm so glad I'm here." So it was just it was a perfect moment as a director to have that kind of direct engagement with an audience person who I don't know, who doesn't know me. And that's one example. Some people are frustrated with us. They don't like the noise. They don't like... I think there's some people that wouldn't like anything happening. You know, there's people who've lived through a lot of trauma that keep themselves in their rooms and that are unhappy when something new comes along. But I'd say the vast majority of people are pretty excited about... something happening.
Someone told me, like, that takes so much heart to do that about the dancers. And I was like, I know, I'm expecting to see them in the air when I walk outside. And when I do and I see them let go of the building, my heart still stops every single time. He's like, it takes so much heart to do that.
What have you heard, Katie, especially from people who feel like their stories are being told accurately?
Well, we just recently produced a play about the Compton's cafeteria riots. So this wave of LGBT activism in the 60s, the queen trans community, is a story that, and that particular instance in history is really something that we've brought a lot of attention to at the museum. So, I mean, I've seen lots of incredible incidences of people from that community seeing the play and really feeling like their stories were being told and feeling really moved by that and really included in it. And we really went out of our way to make sure we got as much community feedback as possible. We workshopped the play many times and really listened to the community and took all their notes and experiences. And the play is written by Mark Nasser and Colette Legrand and Donna Persona. And the two ladies are... longtime collaborators of the museum and were queens in the 60s in the Tenderloin. So.
And for people who aren't familiar with the Compton cafeteria riots, can you give us a brief synopsis?
Sure. So there was a thriving queen community in the 60s in the Tenderloin. The Compton's cafeteria riot was one of the only restaurants in the entire city that would serve them. And it was a gathering spot, you know, a safe haven, a place where you could go and check in with your friends and buy one cup of coffee and sit for hours. And there had been a lot of kind of gay activism, like in that community at the time. The Vanguard was organizing. And we really think that that was like the motivation that when the police raided the place, so when it raided their safe space, a queen threw a cup of coffee in a cop's face. And what followed was the first known militant resistance to police brutality by the queer community in U.S. history, so predating Stonewall by 3 years. And there was lots of gay activism going on in the Tenderloin at that time. And I think what's so important about that is that it's not just like we're before New York. It's that things like that were going on all over the country at this time. Mm. And when you think about what the gay history that most people know about in San Francisco, you think of Harvey Milk and the Castro. And this really is like brings it one decade earlier. A lot of trans women, a lot of women of color were the ones that actually were the ones that sparked this movement. And it's really giving them back their rightful place in history.
I mean, it's amazing because we have all benefited from this activism, especially
Absolutely.
From these marginalized activists. And I love that the Tenderloin Museum exists and that you're doing this piece, Joe, to raise awareness about this. But I mean, what else can we do to make sure that we remember this history? And I mean, it's so important when you think about where we are today and how we got here.
Yeah, the play actually won Best of San Francisco, and that was my favorite little recap of the play because it said Best Reimagining of History. Mm. And then it said that the museum's really done a lot to, you know, save this event and reclaim it for the Tenderloin and for San Francisco as an important moment in history. And this history is really important to everyone in the world and to everyone in that community and the larger community.
And Joe, an entire segment in the piece Tender is dedicated to the trans movement. And you have a portion of the piece is called The Queen's Wave. It chronicles transgender activism throughout the 1960s. And San Francisco was a leader, really, in this movement. Talk about, and you love doing history when you look at your piece, when you do your pieces, which is great. Sometimes you bring in historians. What was most important for you to convey in that performance about the people involved and their impact?
Well, we are not a theater company, so we focused on queer women of color as actors in the Tenderloin, but it is dance. So I just do want to clarify that. You're not going to come and see a speech or anything like that. It is dance. Two things that were important was to cast a trans woman in the piece, mm-hmm. and we're very fortunate to have Honey Mahogany with us in the production. She gloriously is both a drag queen and a wonderful performer, as well as a hardcore activist around trans issues in the neighborhood. So that was really important to me. And, you know, as I was reading about transgendered women, I came across the phrase performing femininity. And that was really a key phrase for how I directed the dancers, how I directed the costumer, Jamie Lynn, who came up with an incredible set of costumes. And one of the things we've talked about a lot is that the women in the 60s were not the same as drag queens now because it was such a different time. They were looking to look like ordinary women of the 60s. So the kind of hyper-exaggeration that you see in drag queen culture now didn't exist necessarily back then. It was more about fitting in and conforming. And so our costuming is, you know, we've tried very hard to go for a genuine look of the 60s rather than necessarily an exaggerated kind of femininity. But so those were just some of the considerations that went into the piece.
Joe Kreider is choreographer of Flyaway Productions. She's also site artist and director. Flyaway Productions is a dance company that exposes the range and power of female physicality. And their new piece is called Tender. And you can see Tender from June 7th, which is today, through the 16th at 380 Eddy Street if you are in the Bay Area. Performances are at 8:30 p.m. on Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. A matinee performance will be at 12:30 on Friday, June 8th and 15th, and then additional performances at 9:30 on Saturday, June 9th and 16th. The performances are free and open to everyone. And we're also joined today by Katie Conry, executive director of the Tenderloin Museum. And we'd love to hear from you. There's such a rich history of marginalized activists in so many cities across the country. And if you'd like to talk about the role that you think art can play in really amplifying their legacy. I feel like there's so many amazing dances now and plays and just so much awareness raising around this issue. So if you've seen anything that really stood out for you, or if you have any questions for Joe and Katie specifically about marginalized activists in the Tenderloin in San Francisco, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org or head over to KALW's Facebook page, click on the video, and then you can leave a question there. Joe, you were talking earlier about the Vietnamese man who approached you. Mm-hmm. And in the segment, The Boat, you set out to honor Vietnamese leaders who fought for immigration rights in housing, healthcare, education, and public safety beginning in the 1970s. Is it Au Co? Vietnamese mm-hmm. Cultural Center is a partner in the production. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about what you learned and tell us more about that collaboration.
So at the outset of the project 2 years ago, I knew I wanted to work with a Vietnamese composer if at all possible. And I spoke with the folks at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, and they recommended that I contact Van An Vo. And she is an amazing composer in that she sources from traditional Vietnamese instrumentation, her own vocals, as well as experimental music. So she's this blessed combination of traditional and experimental creation in sound. And so she's been a key person on the project. She connected me with this miraculously amazing woman named Hang To, who runs the Oko Center pretty much single-handedly. And Hang set up a series of interviews for Van An and I of folks who are working in the Tenderloin who are Vietnamese immigrants. So we interviewed people who ranged and aged from, I think, about 20 to someone in his late 60s. So we got a pretty good breadth of experience, range of experience from, you know, direct immigrants, people who came over on the boats, who identify as boat people, to their children. And, you know, we learned a lot about what people are doing and why people value their experience in the Tenderloin. You know, what's difficult. It's not all roses. Mm. There's a lot of difficulty. There's racism. There's a lot of issues around safety, especially for the women that we interviewed in the neighborhood. And one of the bits of feedback we got from the Vietnamese community is that apparently a lot of Vietnamese folks don't like to go out at night who live in the neighborhood because mm-hmm. they don't feel safe. And that was another reason why we're doing two matinees, just to speak to people or give people an opportunity to connect with us who might not feel comfortable being out at night in the neighborhood.
I just wanted to comment that the Tenderloin throughout its history really has been a safe haven for people who don't fit into society's mainstream. So you see that in the 60s with the queer community, and then you really see that in the 70s and 80s with basically refugees from the Vietnam War, from Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, mm-hmm. moving into the Tenderloin in huge numbers because it was the only place where they could find housing.
Right, so again, specifically, the landlords in the Tenderloin were the only landlords in the city willing to work with the refugee organizations and mm-hmm. take on tenants who had no rental history.
So they have a very deep relationship with the neighborhood. For the most part, a lot of them live outside of the neighborhood now, but they're still very active in it, and you still see that with Little Saigon and the restaurants there.
Katie Connery is executive director of the Tenderloin Museum. Joe Kreider is choreographer of Flyaway Productions, and they have teamed up to present Tender, A Person Who Takes Charge. And you can find out more about this performance if you live in the area. It is free. You can see it from today through the 16th at 380 Eddy Street in San Francisco's Tenderloin neighborhood. Performances are at 8:30 p.m. Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays. There's a matinee performance at 12:30 on Friday, June 8th and 15th, and head over to yourcallradio.org to find more information. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after a short break. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will be talking about who owns the media. Do you know who owns your local newspaper? You might assume that it's a massive media chain, but these days, many papers are bought by hedge funds with little interest in newspapers beyond the profit that they can produce. Many journalists are now organizing and fighting back. And so we will talk about the future of newspapers in this country. Today, we are talking about a new performance here in San Francisco's Tenderloin neighborhood. It is called Tender, A Person Who Takes Charge. It's an exploration of San Francisco's Tenderloin as the home to the outcasts and impoverished members of our society. And it pays tribute to how these outcasts shaped the neighborhood. If you live in the area, you can see Tender today through June 16th at 380 Eddy Street. You can find all of the performance times at yourcallradio.org. These performances are free and open to the public. Joe Kreider is choreographer, sight artist, and director of Flyaway Productions. It's a dance company that exposes the range and power of female physicality. Flyaway dances at the intersection of social justice and acrobatic spectacle. And I really hope you can see this because the women are just amazing. And Katie Connery is executive director of the Tenderloin Museum. And if you have any questions or comments for Joe or Katie, or if you'd like to talk about the legacy of marginalized activists and how artists are really amplifying their legacy, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If there's a piece of history that maybe you recently learned about and you'd like to share it, you can also email your call at kalw.org. Just to spend a little bit more time on the Vietnamese, Cambodian, and Lao immigrants who came here and actually were able to live in the Tenderloin. As you said, Joe, it wasn't always easy, but they were able to actually rent a place. It got me thinking about how even on our show, we don't spend much time talking with people from these communities, Vietnamese, Cambodians. Why do you think that is? I don't think they get much media attention in San Francisco. I mean, I know that they've got specific media in their communities, but I'm talking about overall media. Why do you think that is? Katie?
I would just say that the Tenderloin really was the only place that would accept them. And we also have seen waves of immigration from lots of other places as well. Mm. Again, that high density of affordable housing. So there's been waves of immigration from India. And then more recently, you're seeing immigration from Yemen and other places in the Middle East in the Tenderloin. Yeah.
Well, it made me think about something. We'll have to think about doing a show about it.
What you just made my life worthwhile, Rose, because that's what art does. You know, we've just pointed out to you, a journalist, a gap in the city's voice. You know, without this performance, without all the funding that went into it, without all the partners, we're partnering with the Asian Art Museum as well. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the best of how art affects social change. So thank you, Rose.
Well, thank you. It just made me think about, we do a lot of shows about race and marginalized communities, but really not about those communities. So I'll have to talk with the team about that. Joe, let's talk about another segment in the piece. It's called Nine Ladies Dancing, and it spotlights young, single, working women who worked in the neighborhood in the early 1900s. And at that point, San Francisco was overwhelmingly male.
Yeah, this is in many ways my favorite bit of history because it is so feminist-based. And, you know, this city was founded by men, and women came later, or women came as prostitutes or as, you know, a support system to the men that came to, you know, find the gold or, you know, whatever it was. And in the teens of the 20th century, women were for the first time working on their own and going out at night unaccompanied, quote unquote, which for that time period was a really radical thing. And they were working in the shops on Market Street and living in the Tenderloin in single rooms. And the moral forces of the city were really unhappy about that. And I actually have a quote. This will show up in the program, but this was written in 1917 in the Bulletin, which was the journal of that time. And a married woman, that's how she signed her letter, wrote, "Man does not like the awakening of women. He fears she will destroy civilization, and she will. Man-made civilization, with its inequities, injustices, and hatreds, must go." So that was written in 1917. You know, sometimes I think as contemporary feminists, we think we've invented the wheel on the language around, you know, gender inequality. But, you know, this conversation is actually centuries old.
So there was a moral panic, basically, and the entire Tenderloin was shut down in 1917. And then it immediately bounced back because of Prohibition.
Tell us more about that. What do you mean it was shut down in 1917?
So it was the same forces that were shut down the Barbary Coast in 1913 also wanted the Tenderloin shut down. I mean, it was specifically about the brothels, but also about these good women who were going to bars and restaurants unaccompanied by men, which was socially radical at the time. And they specifically made laws that women couldn't perform, and women couldn't go to bars and restaurants unaccompanied by men, and then the bars and restaurants shut down out of economic necessity.
Wow.
And then once Prohibition happened, once no one can be there, then everyone can be there again. So it was a very short-lived shutdown. But the Barbary Coast stayed shut down, and the Tenderloin could have, but it bounced right back.
One of the things that we did as dance artists was we researched, well, if these women are going out in clubs and dancing, what are they dancing? Mm. And there were a whole series of dances called the animal dances, the foxtrot, the grizzly bear. And so we have studied that movement and transposed it into an aerial dance vocabulary on the side of a building. And in the piece, we designed a set, a very simple set, which is it's a 21-foot long red pole. And for me, it represented the street. So there's times where they're out on the street, and it also represents the bar, sitting at the bar with your girlfriends unaccompanied. You know, that was a very radical thing at that time.
It was the first time the mainstream really came down on the Tenderloin for its non-traditional values, but it certainly wasn't the last.
Tell us more. I find this so interesting. Tell us more about the women and the interactions they had with the public. How did the public, how did men respond to this?
I mean, women and men were living independently in SROs. And so another reason why the Tenderloin has always been this nightlife district is because there's these single rooms without kitchens or living rooms. So there's, you know, everyone does all their eating and drinking and socializing outside. And then they were making their own money. So, I mean, I would assume that there was a beginning of a change in the dynamic of power between men and women. And you really see that in direct quotes from the moral crusaders who were trying to shut down the Tenderloin and also shut down brothels, is they were saying women should make less money than men. They should be dependent to men. So you see how it was very systematic. Wage inequality has a lot to do with power. Mm. And that's still incredibly relevant today.
Mm. That is Katie Connery. She's executive director of the Tenderloin Museum. We're also joined by Joe Kreider, choreographer of Flyaway Productions. And Tender, A Person Who Takes Charge, is a new piece that explores San Francisco's Tenderloin neighborhood as home to the outcasts and impoverished members of society. It pays tribute to how these outcasts reshaped their neighborhood. And Tender runs from today through June 16th at 380 Eddy Street in the Tenderloin. If you're in the area, you can find more information about it. Actually, I should mention the performance times because I know not all of our listeners use computers. Performances are at 8:30 p.m. on Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays. There's a matinee performance at 12:30 Friday, June 8th and 15th. Two additional performances at 9:30 p.m. will take place on Saturday, June 9th and 16th. I was specifically just thinking about these elder women activists who listen to the show, who would love to see this and who do not spend time on their computers. So that one's for you. The performances are free and will be open to everyone. I have this image of these women and how we really stand on their shoulders in so many ways.
Mm-hmm. And also, you know, there were these working women who were working in quote-unquote legitimate jobs, but that didn't work out for everyone. And a lot of the prostitution of the era was fueled by economic necessity.
Yeah.
And some of the most radical activists in the neighborhood were the madams.
There was the first ever sex workers' rights protest happened in the Tenderloin, Reggie Gamble made this empowered, like, passionate speech. They basically invaded a church and said, "You can't trust in God when shoes cost $10 a pair and wages are $6 a week.
Wow.
And you're cutting off our livelihood and not giving us any other kind of economic opportunity," when they were closing the Barbary Coast. And you're like, what do you intend us to do? A lot of these women are mothers. How do you intend us to support our families?
Hmm. I mean, there are just so many parallels to today.
Very
when
much
you think
so.
About wages and how difficult it is for so many people to make ends meet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't wait to see this, Joe. Let's talk about Kathy's Dance. It's a piece honoring Kathy Looper. And she and her late husband, Leroy Looper, purchased the Cadillac Hotel back in 1976. Tell us more just about the Cadillac Hotel.
Well, it's the first ever supportive housing nonprofit SRO on the West Coast, and it's really become a model for supportive housing in the Tenderloin and the city and the area. Kathy Looper is still our board president and landlady. Leroy passed a few years ago, but the Cadillac is still an incredible supportive community. They have events there as well. They have music events, and we really have, the Tenderloin Museum is in the ground floor of the Cadillac Hotel, so we have a great synergy with them.
When I first conceived Kathy's Dance, I thought, okay, there's several things going on here. One is that in 22 years of dancing on buildings, we have only ever danced on a woman-owned building one time, and that's the women's building.
Oh, wow.
So this is the second time ever we've had the opportunity to dance on a building owned by a woman. Of course, it was owned by she and her husband, but Leroy passed away. But I do consider it now a women-owned building.
Hmm.
And my thought was to really honor the work that she's done in housing. But when we interviewed Kathy, she's so deferential. She's just like... amazingly, not shy. She's not a shy person at all, but just very deferential about her accomplishments. And so I made a choice to go with that. And so we interviewed several of the residents there too. And we chose to tell the story of a Cadillac resident named Mary Lopez, who lives on the fourth floor. Her head might pop out the window during the performances. And Mary tells her story very convincingly and lovingly and painfully also in the piece. And so we chose to focus on her story as a way of honoring Kathy's deference.
I think that's a great honor to Kathy. She would want to amplify the voices of her community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So,
can you talk a little bit, Katie, about people living in SROs today and... Are they secure in their housing at this point? Because so many people are not in San Francisco because housing costs are so high. What is it like for people living in SROs?
I mean, for a lot of people, this is a step up from living on the street. So they're leaving a much worse situation and having some secure housing. I mean, not all SROs are the same. A lot are run by really incredible nonprofits doing really incredible work, and a lot of them are protected housing. I mean, I do think being in a room by yourself can be very lonely for people, and that's another reason why it's so important for us to have events at the museum. We have weekly public events, and that's a way of really not only exploring the history, but also celebrating what's going on in the neighborhood now, and also providing kind of social experiences for people. And there's definitely a few people that live in the Cadillac that come to every single one of our events every single week. Mm. They walk by and see it on the chalkboard, and then they're always there. And I know like places like the Cadillac and other groups are very involved in getting residents out of their rooms and into activities. But, I mean, a lot of times that's a much older community, so it can be pretty difficult sometimes. People have mobility issues. So I think there's a lot of people doing some good work there, but there's also a lot of isolation as well.
And I would put it to you, Rose, to have a show where the people sitting here are SRO residents, because, you know, we are witness to that experience, Katie and I, but it is not our experience. And then I also just wanted to mention Sky Watchers, which is an arts-led effort in the Tenderloin. It's an amazing bit of, you know, live cultural legacy that gives opportunity for people living in the Tenderloin, in the SROs who are artists, to practice their art for the public.
Skywatchers is incredible. We've hosted them at the museum a couple of times, and it really is an incredible example of what art can mean to people and to a community.
And again, we mentioned this earlier, but in case you missed it, SRO is a single room occupancy. Joe, did anything else stand out for you when you talked to people who lived at the Cadillac Hotel?
The Cadillac, and this is an indirect quote from one of the men that we interviewed there. You can see the beauty that the building once was and was intended to be, and you see the ways it is also fallen. Because there's no resources to support what needs to happen to maintain someone's living space. You know, house maintenance, room maintenance, residency maintenance is expensive, and there's no money for that. We don't prioritize that as a city or nationally as a culture. You know, we shove a whole lot of money into killing people in wars in places where we shouldn't be, but we don't prioritize people's living.
And I wonder how that'll change once we get a new mayor.
Oh, I'm so hopeful. I was so hopeful that so much of the mayoral race focused on housing and the unhoused and housing insecurity. And I'm so hoping that a candidate emerges who, you know, will really put his or her money, hopefully his, where his mouth is.
I just want one quick other note about SROs is that even though they're called single room occupancies, they're often shared by more than one person. And with the Southeast Asian immigration, that was the first time families started moving into the neighborhood and children started living in the neighborhood. And you saw, you know, multi-person families all living in an SRO, and you still see that today with the new waves of immigration. And actually, there's quite a few Mexican families that live in SROs in the Tenderloin now that have been displaced from the Mission.
So multiple people living in one room.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely.
And the bathroom's down the hall, and there's no kitchen.
Well, in some instances, there is.
A hot plate?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's variations, sure.
Are you seeing more of this now with multiple people living in one room?
I think it's pretty similar because there was a huge amount of that in the 70s and 80s with the Vietnamese immigration.
What would be an average rent right now? Because sometimes I take clothing to St. Anthony's, which is an amazing organization, and just talk to people casually, and they're in the Tenderloin, and they say they can't even afford to live in an SRO because the prices are going up. I mean, I know it varies.
Yeah, that's a very difficult question to answer because most people are getting support.
Today we are talking about an incredible new performance. I hope you can see it if you live in the area. It's called Tender, A Person Who Takes Charge. And it's an exploration of San Francisco's Tenderloin as the home to the outcast and impoverished members of society. It also pays tribute to how these outcasts reshape their neighborhood. And Joe Kreider is choreographer of Flyaway Productions, an amazing dance company that exposes the range and power of female physicality. They're dancing on buildings, flying through the air. It's really an amazing experience. Katie Connery is executive director of the Tenderloin Museum. And if you can see it, it runs from today through June 16th, 380 Eddy Street, 8:30 p.m. on Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays, 9:30 p.m. on Saturday, June 9th and 16th, a matinee performance at 12:30 p.m. on Friday, June 8th and 15th.
And if I could just mention briefly, we're also celebrating our three-year anniversary on Saturday.
Oh, great.
And we're exploring a whole day of free events. We're exploring the themes of Tender, including a drag queen story hour at noon. And the Exploratorium will also be here at that time doing some prototyping.
We have about five
minutes. It's all totally free.
Totally free.
Yeah.
We have about 5 minutes. And I want to ask both of you, what was it like to put this piece together, work on this piece, interview so many people at a time when we have massive inequality, people are very uncertain about where we're going. There's a lot of anger and frustration in San Francisco because so many people are losing their homes. What was that like for you, Joe?
Well, I feel like everything that the Trump presidency was enacted and activated prior to Trump being elected. So I feel like I've been working in a context, you know, I'm 53 years old, so my adult life, the mechanisms of income inequality have been churning deeply during my adult life. And that's been a huge focus of why I do what I do and what I focus on. So I just feel persistence, that lovely word. So, you know, this project is one of persisting in a vision of using art as a tool for social change.
What about you, Katie?
I would agree with that.
Right, because this is nothing new. But I do feel like in San Francisco, I mean, we're losing so many people of color and so many activists. Mm-hmm. I have a dear friend, Marilyn Fowler, who is a longtime women's rights activist. And she lived on a fixed income in Hayes Valley for many decades and got kicked out. Her place just missed rent control by 1 year, and her rent almost doubled. So she had to move down to LA to be near her sons. And then she had a stroke. And she said, this is one of the most stressful things I've ever dealt with in my life. So we're losing a lot of these amazing activists.
Right, and we're losing our artists as well.
Right.
I mean, every single one of my dancers as of July does not live in San Francisco.
Wow. Is that a first?
Yeah, that's a first. Most of the crew does not live in San Francisco. Not all, but most. Our event manager just found out her building's being sold, and so she's facing this great insecurity about what's going to happen with her. The other thing I wanted to say is that what's going on the street viscerally is really difficult. I mean, yesterday I stepped in a pile of excrement during the dress rehearsal on the sidewalk. And, you know, that's really difficult. Mm-hmm. That is a humanitarian crisis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We are living through a humanitarian crisis. To have to sleep in a tent, or not in a tent even, on the sidewalk, that's a humanitarian crisis. And I feel like, as a city, we're too good at ignoring that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and when we're talking about increased inequality, there's so much more wealth here now. We just landed, it's actually the Bay Area, but with a focus on San Francisco, we're now number 3 on the billionaires list when you look at cities around the world. Number 3.
Mm-hmm.
So massive wealth and so many bodies on the street. As you said, some are on cardboard, not even in tents.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like I said earlier, there's so many social services in the Tenderloin doing so much incredible work, and there's still obviously so much incredible work that needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
But these are huge national, global problems that you really see viscerally in the Tenderloin. But, the Tenderloin has a lot of services to help with these problems, and that's why people are there.
What would you say? I mean, I always think about what we can learn from history and how in many cases, unfortunately, we do not learn from history.
True.
But what stood out for you when you did your research, Joe, and working at the Tenderloin Museum, looking at, because this is nothing new, but mm-hmm. what can we learn from those activists?
Philip, who is the executive director of the Southeast Asian Cultural Center, we interviewed him, and he's quoted in the piece as saying, in this country, you have to dare to raise your voice. Mm-hmm. And this is coming from someone who's a Vietnamese immigrant, and that wasn't necessarily the cultural norm where he came from, and it's something that he has had to learn. And so that's a great guiding light to me, is that, you know, dare to affect change, dare to stand up, dare to speak out.
I would quote Cecil Williams' radical inclusion. He was an activist through Glide Church. Glide Church is still very active today. And the message of just unconditional love and radical inclusion, the idea that by helping lift people up, it's because they're no different from you. And I see in many organizations in the Tenderloin a real effort to serve the real person and that person's needs. And we get that through listening to people and listening to what they need. And I really I'm really moved every time I see that. And I think there's a lot of organizations doing great work like that, like Larkin Street Youth Services, Hospitality House, Glide, St. Anthony's, and Gudio Project, too many to name.
So many.
Yeah.
I think Code Tenderloin is an incredible antidote to income inequality, because Del Seymour, who founded it, said, we need jobs. You know, it's nice to, you know, get a meal, but we need jobs.
Yeah. And he's really, it's a lived experience. You know, he was homeless in the Tenderloin for many years. He was a drug dealer for many years. So he's really coming at it from knowing, having like real experience in like how to best serve people in those same circumstances.
Jobs with dignity that pay a living wage. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You have to say that now. Because
yes,
so many of
and,
them don't.
And I have to say, because of the Reynon Foundation funding of this project, we're paying a really, I think, great wage to people. And, you know, our goal is that, so we're doing event management training to people, giving them skills. And there's a ton of events in this city every day. Mm. You know, all those, Moscone Center events. And so hopefully we're, you know, leaving some kind of drop in the bucket long term. Training experience, job experience for people to go on to the next job.
And Code Tenderloin is how the Tenderloin Museum hires from the neighborhood as well.
And 1 minute left. Katie, you've watched practices. What can people expect from Tender, a person who takes charge?
I expect to be blown away. Absolutely astounded.
Joe?
Expect to stand up. We have a little bit of disabled seating, but it is a standing audience experience. The show runs about 35 minutes, and we hope you'll be moved.
Joe Kreider is choreographer, site artist, and director of Flyaway Productions, a dance company that focuses on the range and power of female physicality. Katie Connery is executive director of the Tenderloin Museum, which is in San Francisco's Tenderloin neighborhood, and Tender runs through today. From today through the 16th, 380 Eddy Street, if you live in the area in San Francisco. Performances are at 8:30 p.m. on Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. An additional performance at 9:30 p.m. will take place on Saturday, June 9th and 16th, and a matinee performance will be at 12:30, Friday, June 8th and 15th. And then the special day of events with the museum is on?
Saturday, June 9th from 10 hours, 12 p.m. to 9:30.
And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Joe and Katie, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you, Joe. Can't wait to see it. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. If you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can leave us a review. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.